The date today is the 4th of June, 2013. I'm sitting in my kitchen with Jay Jackson. I just want to say thank you very much for coming to meet with me.
My pleasure. And it's a mutual kind of commitment, I think. Yeah. I think yours is probably a lot more formalized, but I like what you've described as taking place.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to start by asking you to tell me when you lived in the neighborhood, and then I'm going to digress because you and I have had friendship for many years.
Indeed.
So let's just start with when your family lived in this neighborhood and where.
The Jackson family, at least this wing of it, my grandfather being Harold A. Jackson Sr., Harold Augustus Jackson, built the house that I and my father were born in at 238 Brunswick Avenue. It was a semi-detached next to his brother at 234, and that was Bruce Jackson. So the two Jackson brothers, or two of the Jackson brothers, simultaneously dug their foundations and basements and built the houses adjoining one another. And they still stand to this day. At least the property is still, I believe, Jackson property. The 238 certainly is. 234, I'm not clear what ownership remains, but I believe it's still in Faith Jackson and Bruce Jackson's family. That's the wing.
What year was that?
When they were built?
Yes.
Oh.
Approximately.
My father was born in 1918, after the First World War, maybe?
Yeah. Generally.
Generally, yeah, because my dad was born in 1922, and he was the first and oldest of... he was Harold Augustus Jackson Jr. Right? Thank God my mother refused to let them do a third on me. But the family, as far as I knew, up until 1952, I didn't know the Jacksons lived anyplace else beside Brunswick Avenue, only to discover certainly a lot of other properties that were part of the family's portfolio. But there were so many other relatives either occupying or managing them, and they were throughout downtown in a couple of areas. Roxton Road was one. There was some talk of my great-grandmother having held the property that later became City Hall in Eaton's. That was because of her ignorance. She was, the tale goes that it was X'd away. She signed off on a document not recognizing what she had signed. So that's either myth or fact, and we've never been able to establish that, but there was considerable property in the Jackson, as I say, portfolio.
So that was something that your family valued, owning property.
Yeah, if you can appreciate the deeper background of the escape from slavery via the Underground Railroad, to be not only free, but to be a property owner, mm-hmm. was a complete and new and remarkable phenomena for people who were essentially illiterate. And with the promise of 40 acres and a mule if you fought for the British and a number of other incentives that brought a lot of those who were fortunate enough to make the trip and not be recaptured or killed, those who made it here had a chance at really being a property owner. Unimaginable in the States in the 1830s and 40s. I believe Carolyn Smars Frost, the author, had us arriving in Toronto or Canada around 1840, I believe, as the first escaped slaves, Henrietta Jackson and six kids by herself, the youngest being my great-grandfather, Albert C. Jackson.
So I wanted to clarify that Albert C. Jackson was mm-hmm. your great-grandfather.
That's right.
Okay. And Henrietta came with six children.
Six children, and I think there were four or five left behind. For a variety of reasons, none of which are completely clear, but the story goes not only did she get the six up here, others escaped and later rejoined, and we had what was probably considered a full family and a bit of a miracle that two sections of the family were able to get free and get up here. My great-great-grandfather apparently provided the camouflage and the behavior erratically so that his wife and the kids could escape. They were chasing him while they made their escape to across the river.
So he took them on a different scent.
That's right. Pretending to be crazy and everything. which they were getting ready to sell her down the river, and he got wind of it. And the kids were going to be motherless and he wifeless. And before the deal was consummated or that she was to be sent away, he feigned insanity, ran away, attacked Master. It became quite the cause célèbre. Well, all of this distraction on the plantation in Kentucky was taking place. She made her escape.
But what happened to him?
I'm not sure.
Yeah. I mean,
he never got to Canada.
Okay, so he might have sacrificed his life, or pretty probably much sacrificed his life, mm-hmm. so he could distract them.
That's right. Yeah.
That's a brave man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he had watched that from, again, the oral history that's been shared with us. He just had watched too many people on his plantation have their families, and the devastation that it caused to the remaining spouse or partner. And the terms being sold down the river is originally, as you know, from slavery days. They were literally sold down, depending upon what duties or expectations. If you were a half-breed, usually the child or progeny of the slave master, and the skin was lighter, there was a good chance, if you're female, you would have been sent down to New Orleans to one of the houses to work. Other than that, it was strictly hard labor. They wanted big bucks and that kind of thing to withstand heat, and Louisiana was very, very, very cotton rich at the time, of course, along with several other states, Mississippi, everything else. So there was a variety of reasons for the master, but mostly it was bottom line, it was profit. But certain requests or needs for certain plantations, if your plantation was able to provide it, you could make a good living buying and selling slaves over and above your crop and whatever.
But the girls were sold, was that into prostitution?
Yes.
So they went down the river.
Yes, but not always to prostitution. I think some of them were, as they used to say, quote unquote, house niggers. They knew how to serve and they knew how to do a bunch of other things.
They were all used.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
of course. Now, let me understand. Henrietta, mm-hmm. was Albert one of the children, of Henrietta's children?
Yes.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. So Henrietta's husband sacrificed his life.
Yes.
Probably.
Yes.
And Albert was one of the children that escaped.
The youngest that escaped. Yeah.
The youngest.
I think he was less than 3 or 4 when he arrived here.
And that was right into Toronto?
Well, I think the first staff, the first stops or crossings were in the Windsor, Detroit area.
Uh-huh.
Ultimately to Buxton and Chatham, Amherstburg, some of them north of Windsor. But the settlement areas were closest to where they could get to Canada quickest. And that's why we had such a major black community in southwestern Ontario, all through Chatham, Windsor, Buxton, Amherstburg, even as far up as Sarnia in those days. That's because they were right across the river from Detroit, and that was really a major crossing point.
So I think you're saying that Canada was a better place. Maybe not all of Canada, but Ontario was.
Ontario was where the network had been somewhat established to receive slaves. And a lot of the general population of Canada was in Upper Canada in these areas. So there was already communal living. And the black community that escaped and arrived here became part of those established communities. In a couple of cases, they actually started a smaller one. I think Buxton had the distinction of being predominantly a black village in the day. Mm-hmm. But most of all, that area of our country, of Canada, unless you went right to the Maritimes, the settlement was here in Upper Canada, which we know is south of everything else. Long story longer, those were the areas that if you got and registered with John Gray Simcoe, I think he was Lieutenant Governor at the time, I'm a runaway slave, I'm prepared to fight for Britain, I want my land. That's been promised if I arrive here safely. So that was a big one, Collingwood, Medonte, all through the Orillia area. That was where some of the 40 acres were distributed to. You know, that's the town of Stainer. Few people know. Mm-hmm. Is a black man. Stainer was a black man. He started that town. So those kinds of historical, anecdotal kinds of things are just that in a lot of cases. It's anecdotal and oral.
Well, that's
so little documentation. Yeah.
When you were growing up, first of all, did you ever meet your great grandfather?
No.
Albert?
No.
So he had died before.
Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. I'm not so sure even... Yeah, my dad knew him. But I did meet Albert's wife.
Uh-huh.
Now, she was... I've confused the name. She was Henrietta, too. I could be... My great-grandmother was Henrietta. My great-great-grandmother. I can't remember her name. You'll forgive me. And I can certainly, for your notes, clean that up for you.
Okay.
I've given her the wrong name. My great-grandmother was Henrietta. They lived on Palmerston, another street.
So your great-grandmother was Henrietta, and that's
right.
Albert's...
wife.
Okay, all okay. Right. So it wasn't his mother. Okay.
No. Right. The Henrietta that I thought was his mother's name that brought him up here just dawned on me is wrong, what I'm saying to you, mm-hmm. because I can't, just went blank on it. I'm sorry.
Okay. When you were growing up, mm-hmm. You didn't meet your great-grandfather, Albert.
No. I met on my grandma, on my...
You met Henrietta?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Go ahead.
Did you, and you knew that he had been the first black postman?
Yeah, I knew that at an early age.
Did that feel significant, or was it just, that's what my great-grandfather did?
I think it was significant insofar as a 5 or 6 year old can see with his own eyes the differences. Mm-hmm. And whether or not it was pronounced or discussed or examined in our house a lot, was never the case, but it was certainly a discussion point about the lot of the black man in Toronto mm-hmm. and in Canada in general. So yeah, there was some pride attached to it and a uniqueness that was sort of passed on in the telling of how special this one guy was.
Did anybody else in your family go work for the post office?
Yeah, my dad.
Oh yes?
His brother Calvin and my uncle Arnold. Of the of the four sons, yeah. three worked for the post office.
Yeah. Oh, so your grandfather was a pioneer, yeah. a trailblazer.
Yeah.
And three of the sons...
Now, all of them didn't stay. My father didn't stay there that long. He was a mailman, but he was, I think, about 3 or 4 years a postman.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And my Uncle Calvin, the second oldest son, was a career postman. He, I think, got 35 years in. And... knew every single person on a beat that he ran for God knows how many years. They all knew Calvin Jackson. And the second youngest, Arnold, was a clerk at the post office for years and raised his family. He later moved in across the street here after
on
we
Gordon
left.
Street.
105. He lived in the house after us. His family.
Okay, so let's move on to... let's just... briefly talk about the JCC because that's mm-hmm. where you and I met each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to come back to all this property that your family okay. owned, okay? How many years ago do you think you and I met at the JCC? When did you start going there?
1958,
57. Oh my,
I started
as a kid.
Yeah,
you were an adolescent.
58 years. Yeah, I've been going there.
Okay.
58 or 59 years, yeah. I started at 12, I believe.
And I wasn't in Toronto yet. I was in Montreal, then California.
Okay.
So I didn't start going to the JCC until 1974.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we must have met mid to late 70s.
Yeah. So tell me how you used the JCC. You started really as an adolescent.
Okay. I think the best example is we're in the late 40s, early 50s. Mm-hmm. And Brunswick Avenue is, like so many of the neighboring seats, an immigrant catchment area north of Kensington where business was done and some lived, depending upon how quickly you progressed north from Kensington, which was a big settlement area for the Jewish community, as you know. A lot of the people started to do the Roberts and Majors in Brunswick, and they started to get property. My whole street from Brunswick to, I would guess, college was a mixture of everything, but predominantly Jewish. My grandfather spoke a very passable Yiddish.
Yes. I love it.
Yeah, for sure. Across the street from me on the northeast corner of Sussex and Brunswick, and I can't remember this, the synagogue shul, but I was the Shabbos goy.
The Nariver?
Nariver's further south.
That's right.
That's right, but I did have friends live both sides of Nariver.
So you were the Shabbos goy, which means?
Yes, it's an art gallery right now at Sussex. And,
yes.
Okay, that was a very active synagogue. I would, and this was worth fighting for with the other kids because it was a quarter every Friday to come in with the beards, as we called them.
The beards?
And you'd have to climb above the pews into an old slot because that's where the light board was.
Uh-huh.
And you had to be a certain age and size to lay down in the slot as you climbed and click, 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 right? Knocking my wallet, come outside. It's a good boy chick here. I was the guy.
I had to
fight off guys who were trying to get my quarter a week, you know. That was automatically guaranteed before I had to paper it. Long story longer.
Yes.
The kids I played with, their fathers went to the original Y in Brunswick in college.
All right.
So they'd be at the Y and I'd be around the corner on Major. At the bottom, they used to have Hader there. So the lot of the kids were getting beat up, okay? The kids with the payas and they had the yarmulkes and all that. I was sort of the bodyguard because they were my buddies at King Edward School, see? And that was a...
So you would go and protect them.
Yeah, and then I think the rabbi sometimes let me sit in, you know.
You went into the services or into the school?
Into the school.
Yeah.
So, well, they got to know me.
Yeah.
You know, so my involvement with the Jewish community, as my mother said, you've been out of the closet since you were six. It was like that. And when they built the new one, It was only natural. That's where my buddies went. So... Moish and Yankel and everybody and Jay and everybody went to the new one. It was cool. I said,
the
look
new
at,
one at Blurin Spadina.
Yeah, Blurin Spadina was the new one. It was gleamy and the best gym and the greatest looking building, and all the old guys all the kids who hung around, their fathers were, you know, some of them were big shooters on fundraising and stuff. So there, I got a little preferred treatment there, and there wasn't too many black kids going at the time, but there was a lot in our neighborhood who. Trust me, my description of what happened on Brunswick Street is not unique to the members of the black community. And at that time, we lived in pretty much the areas that the Jewish community did. Upon arrival, this is like second generation now, they're established in either business or on Spadina, Nishmata business, whatever it was. It was such a natural progression. So there was only 5,000 or 6,000 black people in the city at the time I'm talking about. But I would say 4,500 of them were living in and around the Jewish community in downtown. So what I've just described is, I can name you 10 black guys who had that kind of a status in the Jewish community or an awareness of the Jewish community. And as did the Jewish kids get to learn about the black community a little bit through our families too.
As children, did you go in and out of each other's homes?
Constantly.
You did.
During the Depression on Brunswick Avenue, very few of the men were working. My grandfather was one of the fortunate ones. He worked for a company on Adelaide called the Fred W. Hall Paper Company. 237 Adelaide, I think. Anyway, he was bringing home a regular paycheck. A good number on the street were on food stamps.
Oh.
Our door, we had six, grandparents had six kids. I think five were living at home, including my mom and dad and myself. So we were doubling up in beds and everything else. But our dining room table at 5:30 every night, we had a good part of the neighborhood in shifts because he could afford to buy some soup and feed the block.
Oh, so he was feeding a mm-hmm. lot of neighbors.
Yeah. Yeah. He was an honorary kid.
Yeah. And really you was. Too.
Yeah. We were. And my dad, a little bit so much, but he grew up a lot and then went to war very early. I think he was drafted at 19 or 20. So by the time he got back, his contemporaries were either starting to move north in migration and started to come up to us in the 40s. And then the kids that I grew up with, the other next generation, they started to move up to Eglinton, right? And they started leaving me. Jay, we're going. And as your community grew and it went further north and that kind of thing. And then another influx came. But by that point, I had left Brunswick Street on 1952. Very, very, Brunswick Avenue, very, very despondent. But what happened where we moved was even more Hamish for me. Because I moved below Dundas. Well, I'm right in the heart of exactly the same thing, only a little newer. Some of them were more, you know, it's the first settlement.
More recently
arrived, yes. So it was a quick and easy transition. And more so than the kids I grew up with on Brunswick, the ones that I later grew up with on Grange Avenue are the ones I still have as friends today, that I still go to the JCC with, and who've gone on, and our kids are friends. I mean, it's generational now. Although we don't all live on the same street as I once did, they're all over the city, but we make a point of having stayed together and in touch.
So your entire life, I mean that first 20 years of your life, mm-hmm. which are significant years, mm-hmm. you were surrounded by Jewish people, you earned money, they were your friends,
yes.
and you went to the JCC with
yeah.
them.
Exactly.
And you're still at the JCC. You just turned 71,
yes.
and you are still at the JCC.
Yeah. And still love it. But both of my sons were raised there. The little guy used to be spoiled. The older guy, especially Sunday mornings. Come here, Jackson. The bagels and cream cheese. He'd run around hiding lockers. I mean, they had the run of the place.
Yeah.
And they were the favored kids. There's a couple of other kids that were the same age as Nathaniel and Marlon. Marlon, not so much because he was older when he started to come. He was like 12 or 13. Mm-hmm. But my youngest son, I started bringing around three or four, and he learned how to wrap a towel and stand in the shower around the
as if he had something.
Yeah, like a big guy. Yeah. I want to go in the schwitz.
So it's just several generations of
Jacksons and Jews.
Yeah, right.
You have to forgive me again for a second.
Okay. I'm going to bring us back to the JCC. Mm-hmm. This is decades later,
mm-hmm.
and you and I see each other there, and I've been seeing you there for years.
And but I think it was more the 80s.
Yeah.
More likely than the 70s. I'm thinking of our recognizing we had some mutual friends in Harold and Shirley at one point, or Shirley was at the hospital. Haven't seen much of her since he passed, by the way. But I gotta believe that's around the 80s.
I was at the JCC every day. I jogged with the Noon Hour group. I mm-hmm. was giving the fitness classes. And we all spent a lot of time there.
That's the truth.
Yeah.
And I can remember at one point, certainly in the mid-70s, 3 or 4 days a week minimum. And that was sacrilegious if it was less.
You know? And now it's 2013 and you're still there.
A lot less. But being vertical still is good. So I like that part. But it's down to a couple of visits a week, mostly because I'm not inclined, and I'm kind of monitoring a lot of what I do physically just based on some medical things.
Mm-hmm.
But it's no less attractive to me or no less... a commitment for me. So I may do it less, but it's still important.
Yeah.
It's still very important for me.
Yeah. Well, I think we both share that enjoying the ambience, mm-hmm. and enjoying the people there.
And even that part's changed. And I guess it's better if you're an outsider looking in, but there was a culture that was for at least generationally since I've been involved with the Y that was so rich in the composition of it, the players, the membership kinds of guys. There was what they used to tell me was the downtown Jews. And then the uptown Jews. Well, the downtown guys were the guys that built Spadina and the delis. And that's who the membership was. These people would go to the Y and stay there for the day, sometimes to avoid their wives, sometimes just because it was the place to be.
Well, I think they played cards there, and they
drank
pretty strong stuff in the morning.
And they had very strong. They had their own keys, a number of
that's
them,
right,
to get in. You know, and so there was a special, and it wasn't abused. There was a special kind of environment, I guess, that they had created. That's now missing for me.
It is different, yeah.
You know, not just the physical plant that's different. The membership composition doesn't reflect that old environment.
Well, what we used to think of as the old guys, I hate to say it, but it's
Altacuckers, yeah.
And it's us now, really.
Yeah,
how old were those old guys?
Yeah.
Our age.
Oh, they were very old, not us.
The Altacuckers.
Yeah, the Altacuckers, right. Yeah.
Okay, let's come back to, you said that a lot of people were being fed at the table, and sometimes
home,
in shift,
yeah.
Right.
Well, now, you have to appreciate, this is the Depression. I was not there. This has been told me.
Uh-huh.
But that was a fairly, I won't say a regular occurrence, but it happened often, where there was enough that we could share after feeding the lot and then bringing in a couple of different settings or a couple of different sittings to, you know, small family or something.
But that's true generosity.
That's how it was then.
Because if one person is working, mm-hmm. doesn't mean he's wealthy, but he is sharing what he's earning.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And these were the days my grandfather was a heller, I'm told. He was a hard-drinking, run-to-the-bootleg, make a baby and go to work and then go drink or something, you know. So he hadn't found God yet, but his house, his generosity of spirit and his family, you always knew there was a very good, positive, God-fearing side to my grandfather, which later hit him like a ton of bricks. But there was a period where he was just, the little black James Cagney is what they used to kind of refer to him as.
Did he become religious after that?
He found God more more actively. He quit drinking. He was a notorious drinker. I was going to mention something else to you about Brunswick Avenue. It'll come back to me. It'll come back to me.
When you were living there, your parents, your sister.
She was just born, yeah.
Right. Were there other people living with you, or did you?
Yeah, both my grandparents, a couple of cousins, and one of the daughters.
Were three generations.
One, two, yes.
Three generations. Okay, how many of you were living under your roof? Your grandparents?
Two, four, six. I would say nine or ten in that little two-bedroom house.
In a little two-bedroom house.
It's not unlike Faith across this, or A.C. Jackson's on Brunswick, the one where Faith used to live. Uh-huh. A little bigger. He had, more square footage inside, but it was effectively a two-bedroom. We converted what was later the living room was a bedroom. We made a third out of one that wasn't. But that was the only way you could get accommodated. And as you walk through the old long hallways, similar, you'd go right, of course, right into the dining room as you came in the door. So that's where we could seat people. But surrounding that were the three bedrooms, one, two. Yeah.
So that's what it was. You had bedrooms and a place to eat, which you called a kitchen or dining room, whatever.
Well, that was a dining room. There was a fairly extended kitchen. And at the end of that kitchen, believe it or not, was the washroom where they built it that way. It was personally built, so I guess that's what they could do at the time. So I always found it odd that the washroom was right next to the kitchen.
Which means that all the spaces other than where you were cooking or eating or peeing, all the spaces were used for bodies to sleep, pretty much.
Yeah, in that early part. Yeah.
Well, two bedrooms and eight or nine people.
Yeah.
One kitchen, one bathroom?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was tough.
And
but I didn't know it. I didn't know. Well, you've heard the same cliche forever. Yeah. I was poor, but nobody told me.
Yeah. When the kids were playing, where did you play?
We did a lot in the lanes and on the streets. This lane right here. Where am I? the one between Brunswick and Borden. That laneway, but north of Harvard. And actually north of Sussex.
The kids played a lot in the lane.
Oh, God. We
boys
got
and
butterflies.
Girls, or what?
During my first 10 years of life, there were the odd girl that would come with us on bikes or something. We had our bikes. But mostly it was the same bunch of guys, kick the can, two Maxi Schwartzes, Billy Trainer, Donnie Hatch, Izzy Sidorek.
I love how you remember those names from 65
years
ago.
Yeah, Ralphie. Anyway, it was a group. And we...
And what did you play? You played Kick the Can.
Kick the Can, Relievio, Cars. Every time there was a construction site, there'd be mounds and mounds of sand. Uh-huh. Well, we'd make a village in the sand with these little cars from Woolworths, right on the side of Central Tech. They used to always pile it. Right on the Lippincott side. Uh-huh. No, the Borden side. This one. Yeah, it's now... the art building now, but that used to be open space. And
so you
a bit
remember
of a
before thing. The building was there?
Oh yeah, I went to that school. I went to the art college or the art course there, the original first 4 years. They built that just after I left. I think it's the Gold Hammer building. He was the head of the art department, and they named it after him.
But in the lanes, it was more boys than girls.
Yes, as a place I would say 90% of 90% boys and 90% of the time.
That was your favorite spot to play then.
The lane was good. We could go to Christie Pitts. In the summer, the Toronto Parks and Rec had great summer programs. I mean, everything from baseball, coit competitions, bean bags. I mean, you'd go to Moss Park, you'd go to Christie Pitts, you'd go to play other training groups or other community groups.
The city provided activities during the summer.
Absolutely. Swimming.
Yeah.
A lot at Christie Pitts. Wading pools, not so much. And that continued right down into when I left Brunswick to move to Grange. They had the same program there at Alexander Park, way before the projects and the public housing was built. It was a wide open, great park that you could play ball all day. All day we played ball.
What elementary school? You left just for 3 years, so I'm just going to talk about that first 20 years, other than that.
Six, seven, and eight, I was at Ryerson Public School. 1 through 5, King Edward. Atheistic College, right? So I was always in the area. There was great rivalries between King Edward, for example, and Lansdowne, just down the street, you know, another 6 blocks, 8 blocks.
So rivalries in what ways?
All the sports, all of the stuff. My father went to Lansdowne, I went to here, and mine went to King Edward, and on and on. So those little territorial things, And the parents continued it, too, I mean, they kind of said, when we were in school, we never spoke to them, to school. And the guys would laugh, recalling that same kind of thing. Well, they carried on with their offspring. And it got to be, little community rivalries and stuff like that. But there was always this structured activity that the kids are into today. I know it's demanded to drive them here in the soccer mom syndrome and all of that kind of thing. But we hopped on a streetcar for 4 cents, and we went to Eaton's, and then we got on a streetcar and came back to swim at Christie Pitts with the same transfer.
So you were much more independent.
We were, and it was, I defy anybody to tell me they have had more fun doing the computer stuff that they do now, or the kind of non-active involvement that they engage in. It's very disappointing to me. My kids and children, my grandchildren are even out of that. They do all of the social media stuff, but they're active. They play ball. And they're now 20, they're at university, so it's something we wouldn't let get established in our family. I didn't, and my sons didn't, and the grandkids are not going to
go play outside.
They're going to do something.
And what high school did you go to?
I went to Central Tech for 4.5 years, and I did grade 13 at Northern Secondary. And then I was not very long in the States on a, but it was a track scholarship. But they insisted you have to go to class. I was bad, and I lost it. But I finally did finish after the government sent me.
Having a little too much fun, Jay?
Yeah. It was simply that.
Hard not to, freedom, really? Away.
Away from home.
Do you have any stories that stand out about being at Central Tech in the 50s?
A little anecdote was both of my parents went there. And they kind of met there, sort of. But they really, after getting to know each other, went to Central Tech. My mother often talked about a couple of her favorite teachers who taught her, and it was a history teacher, Mrs. Pine. And she was so engrossed in her history, in the telling of whether it was Sir Walter Raleigh or whatever the topic might have been. My mother said her oral recitation of the stuff was such she started to cry. And she got really into just that kind of a committed person to history who happened to be a teacher. Well, sure enough, grade 9, my first history teacher is Mrs. Pine.
A
generation later.
And she's 20 years older.
She was close to retirement. She was doddering when I got there. But I swear to you, by the third history class, she was shaking and reciting history and started to cry. Said, my mother told me.
Did you tell her that?
I tried to make her remember, and she kind of did, because there were so few black people and kids enrolled at the school. So she claimed to, but at the time, I'm suggesting that she would know my parents. She's, as I say, lucid enough, but on her way to retirement, probably past retirement. But it was a unique little
That's
Central
a lovely
Tech.
Story.
Yeah.
Who made up Central Tech at that time?
Who made the composition?
Yes.
At the time, and it still may be, the biggest technical school in the British Commonwealth. Okay, so that was the flag waving. What they offered better than most, and if you understood the Toronto Secondary School Board of Education, was that every area of the city, what was then identified as the city of Toronto, had three kinds of high schools. You had a collegiate, which was predominantly stream for university attendance. There was the commercial for our female students who went into with the penmanship and the shorthand and the accounting and that. And that was Central Commerce. The collegiate, in this case, is Harvard Collegiate. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Or the trades. Mm-hmm. So you had aircraft mechanics, tinsmithing, sheet metal work. And that were the trades that they would provide for you, including dry cleaning. I mean, they had a major mm-hmm. dry cleaning thing. And also they had the regular student body, regular academic, and a couple of specialties, i.e. the art course, one of the two or three given in the city at the time. And this was the configuration for downtown Toronto. Out west, it was the same. If you went past Dufferin, Bloor Collegiate, Western Tech, which is Central Tech's counterpart, and I've forgotten the commercial school out there.
But three different ones
in every uh-huh. part of the city. So you had a choice of which were, but it was a quasi-streaming is what it effectively got yes. proven to be.
And what did you study? Because then you went to Northern, so you graduated.
Yeah, I had a regular general a curriculum mm-hmm. with an art option, right? So I had about 5 or 6 art classes a week. And when I was asked to leave Central Tech very politely, I had to sit out the rest of the year, and they allowed me to enroll in Northern, who also had an art course. And they were North Toronto, Northern Secondary, and what the heck was the commercial one? Not Lawrence Park. So they were all
Were you
three.
Naughty at that time?
I was,
is that
I was
what
a
you
very,
were
very, very aggressive child. Anti-authority. Yeah, really. Not thrilled with authority now. No.
You've certainly been a success in your life, but authority was something that you could take in limited amounts.
Yes, and it depends who was exercising the authority.
Yeah.
Some people weren't qualified to.
Yeah. So if it was somebody you didn't respect, you didn't want to take it.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And that usually was the one that was in my face the most, you know, and that wasn't a good thing to do. A little aggressive boy then. A little aggressive.
Thank you for talking about the schools.
Mm-hmm.
I had asked you about the composition of the schools. I'm wondering about the composition of
the student body,
the neighborhood as you were growing up.
True.
You talked about Jewish people and
and a healthy dose of Catholicism.
Uh-huh.
One of the community centers that was really big in the 40s and 50s that I attended was Kiwanis Club, Bathurst and Lennox, right there at the corner of Bathurst. It's now the Bathurst Streets Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Downstairs was the Kiwanis Club, of which they were, again, spotted throughout the city. Central, downtown, eastern, and all of that. Girard. And that one was across the road from several public Catholic schools. So there was that component. There was the Jewish component. A very strong and healthy Ukrainian-Polish component as well. And that's still reflected on Beverly, up and down St. George. And then that's sort of out of what we're describing as the Harvard Village area. But, of course, we weren't aware of any boundaries or anything of that nature at the time. So they were certainly an extended part of the community, but also quite recognizable. A lot of the butcher shops along Bloor Street were Ukrainian and Polish, you know, between Spadina and Christie.
Mm-hmm.
North and south sides, and depending on the further west you went, sometimes it became the Italian kind of signage and goods and services. So it was reflected that way, identifiable but very, very homogenous. You know, it really did. Everybody had their pride thing. This is way before multiculturalism was vogue and and the cliche.
And when you say homogenous, are you talking about how people got along?
Yes.
Okay.
In terms of that kind of...
That's where I wanted to go with
it. Yes. The interaction with almost all communities was one of pride. The common denominator was the immigrant experience. Yes. So everybody could talk on that level about what they've experienced. And I won't go to work and this guy to do this. And then they say, you don't know, I'm just Spadina, it's this. And that kind of thing was a very, very common thread for everybody. They could share that experience no matter what the accent or what the culture.
And are you saying that for you as a child,
mm-hmm.
the children got along, the parents got along? Mm-hmm. Where were their tensions or were there not
tensions? Oh, there were tensions. I mean, I wasn't a witness to it, but I think late 40s is a very, very famous riot of non-Jews and Jews at Christie Pitts.
Christie Pitts.
Sure. My wife's father was very much in there. Sammy Gold and Bill Gold. They were two of the Dunkelmans who have written a book on it.
And there was a movie made of it, too, I think.
I think so, yeah. CBC or somebody did a good docudrama thing on it. And there were more geographical tensions, I think, than actual racial tensions. But those were the days of stereotypes. Well, the Chinese were the chinks there, the Jews were the heebs there, and the black people were the niggers there, you know. And they wouldn't do it to your face, but that was the distinctions being made. There wasn't political correctness, but, you know, the easiest way to sort of maybe explain that. But on the surface of the things that a 7, 8, 9-year-old kid would see, everybody got along. Now,
so you felt safe and comfortable.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm really talking about.
And I was a little oblivious. If there were some real divisions in different communities, and I happened to be in a friend's house where a division was supposedly in place, I wasn't aware of it. I was always aware I was black. Mm-hmm. But I felt well-raised and I could accommodate most anybody. It doesn't matter if I'm black. I'm going to charm them. I'm going to, you know, use something that I was very confident about. So I would never experience the true feelings. And as a kid, I wasn't a threat to them. So it was fun that I was probably more or less the host culture in my community because everybody else was new to it until their kids came along. Or my family was my family was more the host culture of that generation that arrived. They spoke fluently. They knew the systems, the ins and outs of the city. So there was a certain degree of respect that came by virtue of being here before them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was that, and that was deferred to, and they deferred that to us.
Yeah. We talked maybe 20 minutes ago about there was more property that your family owned.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of immigrants have that feeling. Let's try to buy property.
That's the buzzword.
Yeah.
That's the buzzword.
But you said something about they owned a fair amount of property. Was it where Central Tech is or across from Central Tech?
It's north of Central Tech, actually, on Borden. And it went the width from Borden to Lippincott, where the parking lot is now, just south of Bloor. Okay, that was Jackson property. There was a series of row houses coming south from Bloor down to Leonard, or Lennox Avenue, rather.
Mm-hmm.
About six properties there that were taken, essentially, because my grandfather and his brother, who was still alive then, were being smart businessmen. They were going to hold out and stick the city up. Well, they just...
So they really
gave them the money, but it wasn't what they were hoping to get or trying
to... Not market value.
Not market value, no. There's a number of properties, or two or three, where my great-grandmother lived, A.C.'s wife,
mm-hmm.
On Palmerston. We had a lot of that one. That's south of college. I don't think there was any property north where the big bulbs, lights are. I don't think that was sort of the gentry and carriage set in there at the time, in their time. It was dying when I was growing up. Roxon Road, I know, over in the Dufferin, Joe Park area.
That's amazing,
mm-hmm.
the amount of property.
But and Brunswick Avenue, two or three, four maybe, on Brunswick.
Does your family own any property there now, or it's all been sold?
I think 105 was...
Brunswick.
No, 105 Borden was one. I think most of the estate has been sold off, and I know when my grandfather, being the last living of the brothers, gave a lot, the Brunswick Avenue property gave to his daughter, who gave it to her son, Monty, who remodeled the whole house. Not sure what the status is now, but it was a nice job. He didn't compromise it in any way. It's a whole new building. The old house, is, other than the lawn, is gone. I don't know that there's anything that you could call a portfolio anymore. Almost all of the family has either enjoyed or sold off and enjoyed it. I was just a level too late, I guess. I didn't get any. But I don't know that. There was quite a number. I would guess somewhere in the area of 15 to 20 properties at one point. And I could be exaggerating. It's not accurate.
Or you might be accurate.
I could be, yeah. I know there were numbers.
It had to do with having freedom and establishing
the acquisition of it.
Yeah.
And at the time, I think, I'd guess and say they were testing the boundaries of the host society, the Britain, by being in a position, how it came about, I don't know, to have the dollars to raise to purchase these. Now, I know there was a whole thing about the first taxicabs that one of my relatives was a part of. The first taxicabs were by the people who are really the stars of the book that Carolyn wrote, the Blackburns, who was a partner of one of the uncles that came up underground. They started Toronto's first taxicabs. They had Hansons. To this day, the colors orange and yellow, that's Jackson colors. We started our first cabs with that, with this Blackburn guy. The TTC in its inception incorporated those colors. And that's ours, yeah.
Your family has some wonderful stories to be very proud of.
Yes, it's true. That one's been documented.
They came from such hardship, and you, I mean, here you are. You've had a very nice life, nice career.
I'm a very blessed person.
Yeah.
I am.
Yeah.
I am. Over and above all of my foibles and shambles and screw-ups, he's looked after me, or she has, I don't know, and it's appreciated. Truly do enjoy this phase of my life.
I'm wondering whether really I've talked a lot with you. Do you have any sense of the neighborhood as it is now, or is it you feel too much of an outsider?
I think there's enough of my recollections and memories here to still make it a valid emotional walkthrough for me. Some of the people and their generations are still here too, as are the physical plants that I remember. Some renovated, some updated, but the integrity is still there of what I used to recall with a lot of warmth.
Yeah, that's where I was going with it. What's your sense of the major changes, or what was good that's still good? Just your observation. You do come to the JCC.
Yeah. Sitting in your home and knowing it's vintage, and it's on a street that I had a very good part of my childhood. My first love affair, I lived on Borden Street. All of those kinds of things. So this street holds great memories. The structures here, and I'm looking at your wonderful house, and I'm saying there is some quality in the antiquity of the neighborhood. You know, there is something that's been maintained that over the 40 years that I haven't lived here or whatever, it still makes it valid. It's credible, and they haven't sold out. I still get that architectural honesty here. It's still honest on Borden and Major and Robert and Liverpool.
So as people might have renovated or upgraded, they still kind of kept the integrity of the neighborhood.
Yes. I sense that the faces have changed, but it's the neighborhood.
It's
been good.
Well, I think we'll stop. It's been such a... Let me ask just one more question.
Sure.
Did your family use Kensington Market at all?
Constantly.
How?
Constantly. Well, especially when my father and grandfather couldn't get the best kippers anyplace else. Except in Kensington. Fresh fowl, you know. Uh-huh. Pricing. You know, your produce and stuff. Yeah, go home and wash it a little bit, but when you're feeding a whole pile, Kensington was the answer. The A&P, I think, was a big chain at the time. Loblaws was just starting to grow to what it became, but A&P was a big one.
Where was A&P?
A&P's used to be on Bloor near Christie.
Uh-huh.
They weren't that handy, but they were one of the big McGillis at the time. The Atlantic and Pacific is was the acronym. And they were bought out, I think, eventually by Loblaws. Mm-hmm. There was a couple of chains we lost, but they were middle and up market. Mm-hmm. You know, so if I've got 14 miles at the table and I need this many potatoes and that much chicken chopped, and that's when they used to give you neck bones, you know, for your dog. Well, dog had to hustle for himself.
Yeah.
We made soup, you know, that kind of thing.
But your family, to go back to Kensington Market, that was...
A regular stop for us,
uh-huh.
A regular one. Especially Saturday mornings. It was a little bit of a ritual. My grandfather had to go to work and drop off my father and mother to pick up the groceries because he worked at the paper company, and I'd ride with him, you know, sometimes. And by the time we got back, to help us unpack the bags, and that was a bit of a pleasant ritual.
Yeah.
Food coming in the house in all of its forms was always a...
You know, what I find such fun to listen to, all these Yiddish expressions that just are part of your vocabulary because you grew up in this neighborhood.
Yeah. And surprise of all surprises, my third and final wife is Jewish. It's that one.
On that note.
On that note, yeah.
Jay Jackson, thank you very much. It's been a total pleasure.
Thank you, Elaine.